And I'm going to bring on another valued writer and a friend, and that is Bo Albrecht. Bo, welcome to the show.
Greetings.
So Bo Albrecht is, I think, one of the best writers at Countercurrents, and that puts him in a very exalted club. And I'm just a little irritated. I look at the stats and I look at the comments, and not enough of our readers agree with me on that. Bo is putting out fantastic material. He did a three-part series on the New World Order that I thought was quite interesting and extremely entertaining. And I just want more of you out there to be reading his stuff. And I thought, well, let's just have him on the show. He's a lot of fun as a writer, and you need to hear his voice more, even though he thinks he doesn't have a good radio voice. So, Bo, welcome to the show.
I'd have to say that you're far too kind.
Well, what I would like to do is I would just like to do an Ask Me Anything session. That was the plan. And I thought, well, why don't I just have you on and we can see how it goes. And I am going to go to Entropy. If you'd like to go to Entropy, folks, it's entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen. And I just want to read a few donations that have come in before we started today. Bob wrote in, sent in $120. This is for the paywall. Thank you very much. Steve sent in $100. I am unable to tune into your weekend live stream, but I listen later during the week and I want to contribute. Well, thank you so much. Jimmy sent in $200. This is for something that he wants a Wyatt nationalist to write on Black psychology. Jimmy, we got somebody working on that. Sesto Fior, maybe I can get you working on that one. Actually, I'll send you this topic. Sesto Fior has sent in $25. You guys are turning into my public radio service. 30 years ago, I used to enjoy public radio and my parents contributed regularly. Now I am an adult and I couldn't imagine giving them a dime. I hope your institutional clout continues to grow without the leftward ideological drift. Best wishes. Well, thank you very much. There's no leftward drift here. My entire shtick has been basically, we need to come up with a really great pitch for our ideas and then get the whole world to drift in our direction rather than try and let them pull us in their direction. And I've always been very dismissive of pragmatic types who say, you've got to be more mainstream. It's like, no, the mainstream needs to be more like us. And yeah, you need to figure out a way of meeting them and getting them over to our side, to our way of thinking. We have to convert people. And if we allow them to convert us, that's just self-defeat. So there's no leftward drift. I want to have a whiteward drift. Let's call it that. We're neither left nor right in some ways, but we are right. I mean, honestly, we don't believe in equality, and that's the big issue between left and right. But I want things to be moving in a more white-centric, white-positive direction all the time, and we're just going to keep cranking things steadily in that direction, and we're going to try and turn the whole damn world around. Do you have any thoughts on this, Bo?
Well, let's see. It looks like your strategy is to pull a counter Gramsci, right? Go after the hegemony by becoming the new hegemony, and well, we're saying not so fast.
Yeah, we want to be the counter hegemony. Archie sends another $3. Is the apparent unity of NATO countries due to rhetoric from politicians and the liberal media actually representative of the population? Well, that's always a very useful question. I have some experience on the ground in Europe with normies, and normie Europeans after the beginning of the war in Ukraine were expressing political ideas I'd never heard from them before. And so I don't think it was because they were just following the media. I think there was a genuine horror that war had returned to Europe. From a lot of people around Europe, there was just a genuine horror, like, oh my God, this again. And I don't think that that's just manufactured consensus. I think that there's a real grassroots horror here that war has returned to Europe. A lot of people spontaneously thought that Ukraine is part of Europe. They weren't thinking of Ukraine as some place that's far away and exotic. This hit home, this hit Europe, and it made a lot of Europeans feel real anxiety. They don't want the war to spread. A lot of them think, though, that the best way to keep the war from spreading is to be stronger, which is true. And so I do think that the uptick in positive feelings towards NATO are real, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. These are the countries that feel like they're next if Ukraine goes. These countries are glad to be in NATO because they look at the Ukraine invasion and they think this is not an argument against being in NATO. It's an argument against failing to get into NATO, because once these countries have the NATO war guarantees, the chances that something like what happened to Ukraine happening to them plummets to almost nothing. Do you have some thoughts on this, Bo?
Well, I would hate to see NATO expanding so much like that. I think the Intramarium idea that was developed a long time ago is kind of the better way to secure independence for the peoples of the Eastern Bloc if they had their own alliance.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Countercurrents actually played a positive role in the Intermarium idea. There was an article by Emile Durand about Intermarium. It was my first encounter with the idea, actually. It was published, I think, in 2015. And I shared it with friends in Central Europe, a couple friends in Hungary. And they said, you know, this is a great idea. I hadn't heard of this. Even Poles that I knew hadn't heard of Intermarium, and it was really part of their own political history. Mm-hmm. And then within a year or two, friends in Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania were all talking about it. And then there were conferences being put on in Ukraine about Intermarium. The National Core Party, which was sort of the political party that grew out of Azov, was interested in this, because a lot of these people saw immediately the virtue of having their own alliance, because they look with distrust on the United States and Western Europe. They think that NATO is a sort of a vector for pause, basically, for bad ideas. I remember years ago when Romania was being talked about for NATO, the United States State Department was demanding that Romania adapt laws about historical revisionism that would have been unconstitutional in the United States as a condition.
Gee, I wonder who's behind that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was appalling. And so a lot of these countries would be better off if they could take care of their collective security interests vis-a-vis Russia, because they all have bad memories and nightmares. Occasionally they wake up sweating, thinking about Russia just because of history. They want some kind of security, collective security arrangements, but it would be better if they didn't come with all the strings leading all the way back to Washington and New York and Tel Aviv that the current NATO situation brings them. So yeah, I think it's a good idea, and I hope something like that happens. And one of the things that makes me so angry about this war is that I think it kind of puts back the date that Intermarium happens and has dramatically increased good feelings towards NATO. Again, before this war, if you asked average normie Europeans what they thought of NATO, they would just sort of, you know, they'd pause and search for something to say. And after this war started, suddenly a lot of them said, oh my God, thank God we're in NATO, or we could be in the same situation that the Ukrainians are in. It really boosted the status of NATO, much to my dismay. Because yeah, NATO comes with strings. NATO has caused the decline of Europe's own defense industries and martial spirit. And those are bad things.
I also don't want us to be spreading our own mass culture there too much. You know, McDonald's and Starbucks in every corner, and have our soldiers hanging around there and all that. And no, let these beautiful countries be the way they are and forge their own destiny.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think McDonald's is leaving, though. Interestingly enough, and this is a shocking... Folks, you know, mark the timestamp here. This is a shocking confession from me. I've always disdained fast food and stuff like that, and McDonald's especially. Back in 2004, however, I spent a month in India, and because I didn't trust Indian food, I met this guy who had just gotten out of the hospital, who having almost died of dysentery because he bought food from some food vendor on the street. I was very, very cautious about, buying food. And I was told that McDonald's was very, very clean, right, in India. And so I started going to McDonald's in India. And I swore to myself I'd keep it a secret, because back home, the idea of eating at McDonald's kind of horrified me. Although I would use the toilets at McDonald's. They were always clean there too. Well, anyway, having visited Europe, I discovered that the Euro McDonald's experience is actually much better than the America McDonald's experience, or even the India McDonald's experience. Because, for instance, the meat has to be actually made out of meat and stuff like that. And, it's actually much tastier than the American stuff. So in some ways, Europe has actually elevated McDonald's rather than McDonald's coarsening Europe. So, take that, European New Right. Okay. Anyway, I do like the idea, though, of Europe maintaining its own distinctness, not just being completely paused with American pop culture. I remember in 2001, I went to the Oktoberfest in Munich, and every 10th song they would play would be some kind of German drinking song. But most of the time, we were sitting there listening to English language pop songs, American and British pop artists singing at Oktoberfest in Munich. And I was a little taken aback by that. That was not the Oktoberfest experience that I was looking for.
Yeah, you go to all these big cities, hear the same music, see the same chain stores. That's globalism. Everything looks the same.
Yeah, yeah. Gadius writes in with $10. He wants to know our opinion on America's founders. So do you want to go first on that? I'm curious what you think about the founders.
Well, I think those guys were all right. I think they're on the right track. Let's see. I got various opinions about some of them. I think Hamilton is right in certain ways. Jefferson was right in certain ways, but these weren't the same ways. If you know what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, spell it out. What do you like about Hamilton? He's like my least favorite founder, to be honest. So I'm curious about that.
All right. So he's, skeptical about the masses and all that, and a little more authoritarian. And Jefferson kind of a little bit too far off into the French fruit bat, Jacobin kind of stuff, but overall not bad still.
Right.
Better than Robespierre, I'll say.
Yeah, this is true. Take this European New Right. I have a great admiration for America's founders and the American Constitution. I think that these guys were head and shoulders above any generation of politicians that has ever existed on this continent since. But then that gives me pause, because they weren't the product of the system they created. They were the product of the British colonies in America, which had been going for more than 100 years by the time independence happened. And they created a system that didn't rear a comparable generation of political leaders. So there's something about their system that you have to say maybe failed there. But generally, I think very highly of it. Let's just talk about the Constitution. The American Constitution is a classic mixed constitution. There's a long tradition of this. Montesquieu talked about the mixed constitution. The British Constitution evolved as a mixed constitution. What does it mean to say it's mixed? It mixes monarchical, aristocratic, and popular elements. And if you look at both European political history and European political philosophy, there are two long traditions here of the practice of the mixed regime and theories about it. If you go back to the ancient Greeks, you look at Sparta. Sparta had a classic mixed regime. Rome had a mixed regime. Aristotle was the first great theorist of the mixed regime in his Politics. If you read Aristotle's Politics, and then you look at the American Constitution, you can see how the American founders were trying to create a society based on the Aristotelian idea that if you had a regime that mixes elements of popular, aristocratic, and monarchical government, that you're more likely to get a regime that actually provides for the common defense and promotes the general welfare. The idea of checks and balances and divisions of powers, things like that, that's all in Aristotle. And it wasn't made up by Aristotle. He was just observing political practice in good regimes, well-organized Greek states, Greek city-states. And if you look at Machiavelli, Machiavelli was an advocate of the mixed regime. So the American founders were very much in the tradition of what you can call classical Republican political philosophy. The thing that I don't like about the founders is less about the founders than the sort of false image that we have of the founders, because there's been a huge amount of historical revisionism about the American founding. And basically, this historical revisionism has been to read them as classical liberals, as Lockean classical liberals. Now, there are certain elements of that floating around. People like Thomas Paine were more Lockean than others, but classical liberalism was not the primary or even the most important of many influences on the founders. They were more influenced by republicanism than they were influenced by people like Locke. And they had all kinds of ideas that classical liberals would have rejected in horror. And the reason why they didn't reject them is they weren't all that liberal. And so they believed in setting down in the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1790 that they wanted to maintain America as a white nation. That's something that today's colorblind individualist classical liberals would regard in, with horror. They didn't regard that with horror. They thought that was common sense. They thought that was wisdom, political wisdom, and they were right. So the founders were a lot less classical liberal and a lot smarter than later generations have made them out to be, especially today's conservatives in America, today's mainstream conservatives who are basically just classical liberals. If you're a classical liberal individualist, you can't really defend the American founding at all. All these guys have to have their statues torn down because they weren't egalitarian individualists like they were supposed to be, or like they were, like we're told they were supposed to be. So
Myself, I don't see such a distinction between the classical liberalism and the founders, but you know, maybe I'm missing a few details here.
Well, in this sense that,
I see that as kind of a one interpretation of classical liberalism. That it's the only interpretation.
Well, here's the main point where I think that classical liberalism differs from the tradition of republicanism is on the idea of the common good of society. There's a strong tendency in liberal thinking to say, look, either there is no common good of society, or if there is, it's not something that can be pursued by the state. And at best, maybe it can come about as an unintended consequence of people acting selfishly. But the idea that the purpose of the state is to secure the common good of society through political action is something that's very much part of classical political philosophy. And it's something that liberal individualists, classical liberals, are very uncomfortable with. Now, if you look at, we look at the Constitution, you know, the preamble talks about, you know, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare, that the common good, the common weal, right? And securing the blessings of liberty. And
for ourselves and our posterity.
And our posterity, yeah. There's a sense that it's not just us. There's also people to come that are part of the community, and we have to take care of them. There's a sense, though, that there's this criterion of the common good that can be pursued by the state. And that is really the thing that separates, say, the libertarians of today, who've radicalized these classical liberal ideas, from what you can call the founders, who were classical Republicans in some ways. And the whole of classical political philosophy has this idea of that there is a collective, that the collective is real, not, as Margaret Thatcher said, society doesn't even exist, right? What are you doing if you don't believe society exists, lady? What are we doing? Why are you running a society if you don't believe it exists, right? There's a collectivity that has a good of its own, and that can be ensured by good government.
And that's what Mussolini said too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so that criterion of the common good is higher than things like rights and liberties. And so you can say, well, yes, liberty is a wonderful thing, equality is a wonderful thing. These things can get out of hand and they can undermine the common good of society. And so there was always a sense that there was a higher criterion here that could rein these things in, even though the founders were very, very confident in the ability of people to get along without government nannies and snoops and regimentation and things like that. They had a sense that could have a very minimal government, certainly much more minimal than we do today, but they still believed that there was a higher standard than my individual rights. And they still believed that you couldn't just have everyone be selfish and short-sighted and it'll all work out in the end. So that's where I think they owe more to classical political philosophy than sort of liberal ideologues.
All right.
So Gadius, yeah, that's my basic take on the founders. I think they were very much in the tradition of Western classical republicanism and political philosophy. I think that they're head and shoulders above the people who came after them, and that might be a problem with the regime they created. They did have a tendency to be a little laissez-faire and blasé about things like education and virtue and things like that. They would have looked at Aristotle, who had said that the purpose of the state is to make people more virtuous, and they would have thought, nah, that'll take care of itself, right? And it didn't. It didn't really take care of itself. But generally, I think they were brilliant. You know, when Madison had this belief that they could create a machine, sort of a mechanical government that could run independent of the character, namely the virtue of the people who were running it, that was obviously a kind of kooky crank notion.
Well, there were others who disagreed with that back then.
Yeah. And that's another thing. You see that there was a lot of division among these people on some of these issues. The most radical liberal egalitarian ideas were hotly contested by other members of that generation, sometimes even by the same guy, like slave owner Jefferson. I mean, the claim that all men are created equal is not a blanket egalitarian claim. It's simply a denial of hereditary rule. That's all it meant in that context, was the denial that the King of England had the right to rule them because of hereditary office. It was the principle of republicanism. And when you look at the Constitution that was passed after the independence from England was secured, there's no talk about universal human equality, but there is a ban on hereditary honors, right? That's all that meant, really.
And there's a first draft of that said all Englishmen are created equal.
Yeah.
I believe it was Franklin who convinced him to change it.
Yeah. So there's a real big distinction between all men and all Englishmen.
Indeed.
One is universal and the other is folkish.
Yeah, just recognizes there are differences in nations.
Yeah. So Friedrich writes in, thank you, Friedrich. He sends $10. Hello, Greg and Bo. Considering how many think tanks there are out there, do you think that some of them or parts of them are dedicated to destabilizing the dissident right? All the best. Well, go ahead. What do you think? Do you think that there are institutions out there, think tanks or whatever, who are getting big checks from probably the usual suspects to engage in psyops to destabilize our movement?
I don't have any direct evidence of that, but I would think that the people you're talking about, it probably crosses their mind every now and then, that we're their enemy and what can we do to suppress this?
Well, yeah, we do have our friends at the SPLC, the ADL. The SPLC has a paid intern who is listening to your voice, Bo, and thinking, how can we dox this man? they have armies of well-paid people out there who are trying to find out, who processes so-and-so's credit card and can we get their account yanked? So we know they do this. There are people who are paid far more than I make to make my life more difficult. It's flattering. It's flattering that people are taking home a large amount of money to make my life more difficult.
And I got
to
say that they're causing bad public relations for themselves. Stop doing that, and then maybe we can get back to
lines you keep recurring to. I wish they would just stop doing that. Have you ever thought of not doing that anymore? But yeah, I mean, there are institutions that we know, watchdog groups that are spying on us, sniffing around, trying to dox us, trying to make our lives more difficult, trying to deplatform us. Okay, that's out there on the public record. We know that that's happening. There's no question about it. So do we have reason to believe that there are other institutions out there, maybe government institutions or quasi-government institutions or private institutions, where people are paid to do more than just deplatform us and dox us, but they're actually trying to destabilize us?
Yeah, there's that COINTELPRO thing since the 60s, right?
And yeah, COINTELPRO. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the United States government was involved in undermining things like the civil rights movement, white power movement, things like that. They haven't hung up their hats. They haven't said, okay, folks, our mandate is over. We better stop interfering in domestic American politics. They haven't stopped doing that at all. So yeah, they're out there and they're trying to undermine us. And well, they sometimes, I don't know how effective it is. Okay. I honestly don't know how effective it is because I can't tell who's working for the enemy and who's just screwing up because they're sincere but dumb, or sincere but twisted, right? And that's the problem, because I do think, okay, yeah, logically speaking, it's very, very likely, just based on past behavior of our government, based on present behavior of our declared enemies, there are people out there to get us, and that would involve undermining us, spying on us, maybe setting up false opposition figures, trying to foment discord and stuff like that. There's no question that that's logical. But then the question is, do you have any concrete evidence that so-and-so is actually doing this? That's where I get a little hesitant. We do know that there are people who were informants like, who was that broadcaster years ago who turned out to be an FBI? Hal Turner? I think that was the guy. We know he was working for the feds and he was, saying Fed posty things on internet radio and probably back in probably shortwave radio. It was so long ago now.
That very term, Fed posting, kind of goes to show you that this is a phenomenon, right?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. The thing is that we know they're out to get us, but if we're paranoid about everybody that we come across, then they've really got us, right? They can undermine us in a lot of ways. They can send people in to muck things up, but a far more effective way of making our movement dysfunctional is just to spread paranoia around that anybody could be doing this. And therefore, I tend to roll my eyes and also push back if people are just sort of throwing out Fed accusations all the time, because well, that's just what feds would do for one thing. But you know, we can't get so paranoid that we'll never be able to organize an effective resistance. And if we do get so paranoid that we can never trust and organize and take the little risks that are necessary to have an effective resistance, then we lose. And it's so important that we win that we can't afford to defeat ourselves, basically, or allow them to defeat us by just becoming scared of our own shadows and unable to trust anybody.
Indeed, obviously, spreading demoralization is something that opponents would want to do.
Yeah.
And defeatism in general, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Reed Johnson writes in that all men are created equal is unacceptably careless phrasing, given that known egalitarian strains of politics or even of that era. Yeah, this is true. You know, one thing I was just thinking about today about this is that every colony, I believe, had its own Declaration of Independence. There wasn't just one, right? And so there were all these documents floating around that people were coming up with. And then, of course, at the time, these people didn't know that they were actually going to win, right? They were hoping they were going to win. If they didn't win, they were all going to hang, probably, or have to flee and lose everything that they owned, etc. But they didn't really know if they're going to win or not. They were setting forth on this journey. And, you know, sometimes you just don't anticipate the consequences of loose talk. You know, the idea that this document would be enshrined someday as this precious piece of parchment would have been, I think, dismissed by people like Jefferson with derision. This is just some memorandum about why we're revolting. It's not a constitution, for goodness sake. And the idea that a lot of Americans have that the Declaration of Independence is somehow law or holy writ, it's not law. It's not the Constitution. The Constitution says nothing about universal human equality.
Okay, so the phrase "all men are created equal," we can actually understand what the context is, and we can also understand that at the end of the document, he's talking about these British are setting these Indian savages upon us who have no rules of war, and these guys don't fight by the Geneva Conventions. Well, you know, he's obviously not being too universalist there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That phrase has been turned into something that it wasn't intended to be. And there's just a great deal of imposture that's taken place to turn the Declaration into a legal document, which it isn't. And of course, maybe he could have anticipated that, but I don't think he could have anticipated that. And if you certainly look at the other things that he said, even if you believe that all men have rights, he certainly didn't believe that all men having rights made all men equally good fits for the same society, because he talked about how one day blacks would be free in America, but they could not be on free and equal terms with white people in the same polity. He was very, very clear about that. You can say that everybody's got rights, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's a good fit for the same political order.
He also said that they should be removed from the reach of mixture, right? So settle in their own country and all that. And, you know, they have their land, we have ours. And that's what the idea was.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, folks, let's see if there are some more questions here. Okay, I have a question. Well, a couple of questions from one of our frequent commentators at Countercurrents, Alexandra. And she sent in a couple of things to me just by email to discuss. And I think that these are good topics. So I'd like to put them out there and see where we go. She had a question about the Georgia Guidestones. She basically wondered what my thoughts were on the Georgia Guidestones. Well, here are my thoughts on the Georgia Guidestones. I've been thinking about this for a couple of weeks, and I was hoping that we could have an article about the Georgia Guidestones by now. I was kind of waiting on that. I read about the Georgia Guidestones, and I thought, you know, the Georgia Guidestones aren't that bad. Now, there are a lot of people in our sphere who think the Georgia Guidestones are some utterly sinister globalist plot, right? And I know you can speak to that, Bo, because you've been writing about the globalists recently. And yeah, there is some talk about how, you know, in a new world order, it would be good to have some kind of international court to deal with disputes between nations, but that each nation should govern itself. That sounds kind of not like a one world government to me. There's this stuff about, you know, maintaining harmony, keeping the population under a certain limit.
Half a billion.
Yeah. Staying in harmony with nature, et cetera.
That means wiping out by far most of the planet if you want to do it right now.
Yeah, I know. Obviously, we couldn't get there without a lot of people dying or failing to reproduce. But the point is that, is this an entirely bad idea? And could this have been set up by people who were not that different from me, for instance? There's one theory that the Georgia Guidestones were created by somebody who was a fan of sort of rightist thought, eugenics, and was thinking that perhaps these Guidestones would survive cataclysm that would bring down civilization, nuclear war, the collapse, things like that, and that they would be around in the future for people starting over, starting a new civilization as Guidestones, as a suggestion for starting a new civilization. If that's true, it's not necessarily some kind of sinister globalist thing. It's not necessarily the Trilateral Commission or the Illuminati or any of these other people who set them up. So I just think it's an interesting question. Who was behind this and what their intention was? Their intentions might not have been fundamentally horrible. They could have been set up by people that I would be in substantial agreement with. We don't know the motive. We don't know the situation that they envisioned under which these Guidestones would actually shape policy. But the idea, obviously, is that they were sinister New World Order stuff, and that somebody who probably has an account on Gab decided they needed to be blown up. Then the weird thing was, is that once one of them was blown up, the local government went in and demolished it. And they did it very, very quickly. You'd think that they wouldn't do that, as Jim Goad pointed out, with a crime scene, right? Isn't that destroying evidence? So Was there some sort of conspiracy amongst the local authorities to take these things down? I was kind of hoping the next time I was in Georgia, I could go see the Georgia Guidestones, but now I can. So you're our guy about the New World Order. What are your thoughts on the Georgia Guidestones?
Okay, so as I understand, it's not known exactly who put it up there and what. There was made substantial efforts to conceal all who did that. It's not as pernicious as some things that came out of the World Economic Forum, but it's a little much for my tastes, really. Now, I'd say enlightened government is all well and good. Maybe international forum for settling disputes, that's fine, but I wouldn't approve of much more beyond that.
Yeah, so the other thing that Alexander wanted to talk about was she read Ira Levin's The Boys from Brazil. And that's, of course, that was made into a movie, and it's kind of corny, but good corny entertainment. But the question really is this. The question that I want to take away from it is this. What should our attitude be towards our own heredity? There is a kind of liberal, I won't even call it liberal, I'll just call it voluntarist attitude. The people who want to strongly believe that they have freedom of the will, and that they are in charge of their own destiny, that they are in charge of their own personality, their own tastes, things like that, that they create themselves, and that things that we don't choose, that are foisted on us by our family or society or, heaven forbid, our genes, are an assault on our autonomy, right? That is a mentality that rails against genetic determinism. And people who have that value system, they are horrified at the idea that your tastes and your destiny, basically, are largely determined by genetics. Now, does that mean that every little choice you make, every, you know, everything you do is somehow determined, predetermined? Well, I don't know. But certainly very basic parameters are, and the best examples, this, the best proof of this is when you look at the many studies that have been compiled over the years of genetically identical people, identical twins and triplets who have been raised apart, sometimes in radically different environments, but they have so many things in common. And the best explanation for all these things they have in common, like, you know, the same, you know, the same taste in music and food and girlfriends and jobs and things like that, is that these fine-grained tastes that we have and the decisions that we make, the things that we think are our free choices, aren't all that free. You know, if you are a single person and you go off to college and you look around and you look at the catalog, you sniff all the flowers, you look at all the options that our society makes available to you, and you, as a sovereign individual, choose to be a math major, well, that's very affirming, right, of a particular image of the self. And then what do you do? How do you feel when you discover that you have an identical twin separated at birth who also chose to be a math major? That undermines our sense of free will and our sense of human dignity, right? That's caught up with notions of free will. My feeling is that we have to revise these ideas of what it is to be human. And I honestly think that a lot of people who are interested in things like genealogy and looking at studying their family histories and things like that, why are they doing that? They're doing that because that makes them feel closer to others. And I think in the same way, knowing that you have certain hereditary traits and inclinations should make you feel closer to others. It's not maybe an assault on you if you think of yourself as a sovereign individual exercising free will. But if you're the kind of person who wants to feel community and connection with people who are similar to you, then blood ties and genetic similarity mean a lot. And the experience of seeing how this affects your life can be not disturbing, but profound and touching, right? When you're around people who can complete your sentences because they understand your thoughts and they share the same tastes and things like that, that can be a very moving experience. And I think that we just need to revise the picture of human dignity that's very much caught up with liberalism, by the way. And that makes people want to rebel against genetic determinism. Bo, I've been monologuing. What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, I think it's very possible to inherit certain tendencies. However, free will is, you know, a real thing. And moral agency is another way to put it. And that also applies to the other thing, environmental influences. You know, what the left always focuses on. I mean, just because you're born to a poor single mother doesn't mean that your life has to be screwed up. You can take stock of what you're doing and say, hey, I want better than this. And likewise, you know, even if you do have like a genetic tendency to alcoholism, you don't have to go down that road if you don't want to. You can refuse that.
Yeah, and I think the Roman Stoics sort of got this right. The Roman Stoics sort of had a strong sense of determinism. They believed in destiny. But they believe that you had a choice about how you played the cards that were dealt you at the same time, and that you could go along with destiny or not. So I do think that there's an element of choice. I don't think we can really deny that. But you can make something out of what the world has made you into. And I do think that you can be wiser or more foolish about how you do that. But even those choices you might find are going to be made pretty much exactly the same way by your lost identical twin. So the question then becomes, who is the you that's making those choices? You can think, okay, I'm a will. I'm this free being, and I'm making choices. Or you can think of yourself as, wow, I'm one of two organisms with a very specific identity, and we're both making pretty much the same choices, but it's still me. I guess that's really the question is, do we think of our genes as ourselves, or do we only think of our choices and the things that we choose as ourselves? If you want to identify who you are as with what you've chosen, then the unchosen stuff becomes an impediment. But if you want to think of your freedom or your life as expressing your genetic potentials, if you will, that's sort of a different way of conceiving yourself.
I'd have to say that this might not be philosophically very sound, but I think we do have to basically go on the assumption that we are sovereign individuals who can make meaningful choices. And if we just act as if we were helpless to whatever destiny puts in front of us, then that's maladaptive and results in maladaptive choices.
Yeah. And even if it's not true, in some metaphysical sense, you can still say that there's a pragmatic argument for taking freedom seriously. You know, it's a thing that I think philosophers are maybe never going to be able to actually integrate together. There are two perspectives you can have on life. You can look at life from the outside, and you can look at all these causal factors that are converging on certain effects that seem very, very predetermined. And then you can look at life from the inside, and you're not experiencing all these causal factors. You're experiencing yourself looking at different options and making decisions. And both of those seem to be true. And the question is, how do you integrate those two perspectives in human beings? I don't think any philosopher has really successfully done that yet. But if you have sort of an expansive notion of who you are as, you know, body and soul, you know, both the things that you choose and the things that seem to be predetermined are still you. It's still you, your unique makeup that's acting in this particular way. Even if you can't help it, it's still you. Okay, I have a couple of sort of quick, cute questions to answer that Eric sent in. So let's deal with a couple of these and then we'll wrap them up. Eric wants to know if we have any race realist films that we can recommend. And then he gives examples, Mel Gibson's Apocalypto or Spike Lee's Jungle Fever, etc. Well, there are a couple of race realist films that I can highly recommend. I've reviewed both of these as Trevor Lynch. One is Africa Adio, which is an amazing documentary from the 1960s about the consequences of white decolonization of Africa. It is one of the most sobering, red-pilling race realist films you'll ever see. Another race realist film that I reviewed is American Pimp, which is another documentary. It's made by the Hughes brothers, who are half Black, half Armenian brothers, Americans. And it's, again, a profoundly interesting documentary that confronts you with not so much IQ differences between the races as moral differences between the races. That's the thing that it really heightens. Because a lot of these pimps, these Black pimps, are not stupid. They have average or higher than average IQs. They're actually entrepreneurs, right? The thing that's really shocking is just how morally different they are from whites. And I thought that was a very profound experience. So I would recommend those too. Bo, do you have any race realist film recommendations?
Let's see. If science fiction is good enough, I would say District 9 has a very interesting allegory right there. Or you familiar with that one?
Oh, yeah. I like that movie.
Where they have the aliens ship kind of lands hovering over South Africa. They come in there and find that they're starving, basically, and they take him down and try to integrate him in human society. Just doesn't work. Also, despite our efforts, they breed rapidly and are up from like 3 million to 10 million pretty quickly by the end of the show. And it's just not going to work. And they don't really try to fit into our society. They're just milling around, cause trouble. And, you know, you feel bad for them because of what's happening to them. But still, you know, how the hell is this going to work?
I thought it was an actually really effective sci-fi film. And it's definitely an allegory for our sorts of issues about immigration and race and refugees and diversity. And the fact that it's set in South Africa, it's really interesting. Any others?
Let's see. I'm racking my little pea brain here.
Have you seen Zulu from the 1960s about the Battle of Rorke's Drift?
It's been a while. Anyway, that was pretty much a war film, right?
Yeah. It's a war film. It's a race war film. It doesn't really have any profound lessons about, you know, race differences in it, but it really scenic and beautiful. I understand why people coveted South Africa as a place to live, because it's really quite strikingly beautiful, the scenery. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's interesting. It's more a study of white types than it is of black types and certain weaknesses that white people have. So Eric also wonders, what is the most difficult red pill you have swallowed? For example, race and intelligence, the JQ, World War I and II, or so forth. What was the red pill that you resisted the most, Bo?
Let's see. By my teens, I was pretty much through all that, done with liberalism. Let's see. Actually, my last one was, you know, the concerning women. I had to unlearn a lot of exaggerated chivalry, shall I say.
Right.
I found out it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it goes against my nature to spit up the blue pill on that, but still, you know, certain things happened and blew up on me, and I had to learn the hard way.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the red pill that I was most resistant to. That is really a good question. In some ways, the JQ thing was very hard for me, just because there were Jewish thinkers and writers that I liked a lot. But once the truth of it dawned on me, it was like, I'm sorry, I can't not think about this anymore, and I can't pretend like it's not an issue. And so there was a little bit of hesitation, I guess, on that for a long time. And then I finally just said, yeah, this is really a thing. So that, I guess, I was the most hesitant on. Race differences, things like that. I was always interested in human differences, human biodiversity. Ever since I was a kid, I was just fascinated. I was fascinated with geography. I was fascinated with history. I was fascinated with anthropology. And I'm fascinated with human differences. And I never had a strong inclination to accept that everyone was the same. I didn't want everyone to be the same. I was sort of a libertarian by the time I was a teenager, and that inoculated me against white guilt stuff and this a lot of the arguments that are made to get people on board with race denial, stuff like that. I didn't feel like I was part of a collective, namely the whites. And I didn't feel guilt for what happened to other people. I looked at blacks and I saw, well, these people have agency and responsibility of their own, etc. And I just wasn't having any of that. And I do think that kind of libertarian individualism sort of works as an inoculation against a lot of the PC stuff about race. And that is one of the reasons why there's a pipeline between libertarians and race realists in the end. You know, you're just inoculated against the absurd liberal positions on these things, because you just don't, they can't get you with the guilt arguments and the sob stories and stuff like that if you're a hardcore libertarian. And so I think that was very easy for me. So it was the Jewish thing that was harder, but, you know, I ended up accepting it in the end because it was just such a colossally powerful case. You know, the reading Kevin MacDonald was really eye-opening for me. It wasn't so much eye-opening, although it did open my eyes in some ways. My eyes were already open to this because I had this friend who was arguing this stuff with me. And I would listen to him and it was like, oh God, you know, he's going on about the Jews again. Oh my God. But I couldn't deny the coherence of what he was saying. And I saw all of these strange things about intellectual movements in philosophy and the world of letters more broadly that I couldn't quite figure out, that didn't make sense. And then reading The Culture of Critique, all of these things fell together in a coherent pattern that simply could not be unseen. And so at that point, yeah, I basically was red-pilled on that. It just took me a little while. Okay, well, Bo, how do people follow your work? Countercurrents, well, I hope, is your major platform now, but where else do they follow your work?
It is. I have my own blog, and which I occasionally have some writings that I'll link to on that one. Doesn't get much traffic, though, so my earlier stuff, though, that was on Return of Kings, and it's still out there, most of it. Some of it got trimmed down, but still find most of the earlier stuff from up to, I believe it's 2006.
No, that's great. Now, what is next? I'm really curious to see what you're, to have a sneak peek about what you're writing about next. I really, folks, if you haven't read his series last week about the New World Order, it's really quite entertaining. It's also quite interesting. It sort of deals with some of the stuff that the more excitable people in our ranks deal with, I think in the most sensible way possible. So I urge you all to read it if you haven't read it yet. It's also entertaining.
I try to keep it to the basics, you know, and not jump off all into the wild tangents that I've seen some other people do. It is really easy to jump down the wrong rabbit holes and get lost, and definitely, but you know, really the way to think of this is it's kind of like a white collar mafia that kind of takes every city government, except it's not the city government. It's lots of countries in the Western world that they've taken over effectively.
I do have a question here from Nick Gilvey. He says, how do you deal with, basically he wants to know how you can prevent hot weather from, making you lazy. you got to get air conditioning. That's the only way. Hot weather makes me lazy. So I've tried to avoid living in hot climates as much as I can. And if I am in a hot climate, I just have the AC blasting. Otherwise, I just become tropical and torpid and lazy and unproductive. There's a lot of truth to this theory about the smarter races having evolved further from the equator. I know that the more equatorial my climate is, the less I accomplish. So just get air conditioning. It sounds like a simplistic cheat, but that's the only thing I can recommend. It's made me much more productive when I've had to live in hot climates. I've lived in a few hot climates. I've lived in Georgia. I've lived in the DC metro area. I've lived in New York. New York summers are kind of miserable. I was the most productive in the summertime when I lived in Seattle and the San Francisco Bay Area, because those have very mild summers.
And I should say the laziness is a choice, so fight that tendency. Fight your natural inclinations, right?
Yeah. And the best way to fight it is just get the AC, seriously. Just splurge and buy the air conditioner. Anyway, so I was asking you, what's coming up next from you?
Do you have as far as articles or as far as written matter?
Yeah, as far as articles and maybe books for that matter. What are you working on?
Okay, so let's see. The next one I was going on was an account from Heinz Hermann Weichart called Under Two Flags, kind of reviewing something that he wrote there about his experiences in Germany back in the good old days. And an interesting character. He's half Jewish, and he goes on about, you know, all the terrible things that happened to him. Except, well, maybe it's not really so terrible after all, as you'll see.
Okay. Okay, I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's that, and also there's that, let's see, book by Heinel that we were going over earlier, Dangerously Divided.
Okay.
Uh-huh. There's also another book out there, Liberalism Find a Cure. That's one that I kind of been going at as well. I'll get to review that one of these days, hopefully.
Well, very good. Very good. I'm looking forward to it all. Folks, I am going to wrap up today. I want to thank Bo for joining me. I want to thank our listeners. We've had about 100. And of course, there will be many hundreds more when we are on the Countercurrents platform later on this week. Tomorrow, Nick Gielvi is going to have Pox Populi back on the Writer's Block. And that is at the same on the same channels on Odyssey and DLive, but at a slightly different time. It starts 1 hour later. He's going to be starting at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern, and 10 p.m. Central European time. So please tune in for that. And I want to thank all our donors. I want to thank our listeners and our moderators for keeping it all civil. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Thank you.